Welcome to the first Jewish Policy Center webinar of 2022. Here's hoping that this year will be at least a little bit less chaotic than last year. On the plus side, the snow is melting here in Washington, D.C., and we hope everyone is dug out, warm, happy, and healthy. There are a lot of you out there today. I know our guest, Aaron Lehrman, is a big draw. And let me encourage you to keep sending your JPC invitation to friends. Before we turn to Aaron, I'm going to introduce the JPC and our work. We are a 501c3 organization founded in 1985 to provide perspectives and analysis of foreign and domestic policies by scholars, academics, and commentators. You can find us on our website, jewishpolicycenter.org. There you can sign up for insight articles and our magazine, In Focus Quarterly. The winter issue of In Focus Quarterly has just come out. The focus is China, what it does at home, what it does abroad, and how the U.S. should respond. And we are well into planning our favorite issue, the spring Israel issue, dedicated to the amazing things that are happening in Israel and the challenges that Israel faces. That's jewishpolicycenter.org. The JPC supports a strong U.S. defense capability, U.S.-Israel security cooperation, and missile defense. We support the legitimacy and security of Israel anytime, any place. As an organization that sits slightly to the right of center, the JPC advocates for small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, and energy security, as well as free speech and intellectual diversity. In this series of calls, and we are coming up on our second anniversary in 2022 of JPC webinars, we've been very pleased to bring you scholars and policymakers on issues including various aspects of Israel and the Middle East, the many and mostly threatening sides of China, Iran sanctions, along with American defense policy, school choice, and the Supreme Court. If you missed a few, you can binge watch on our website. As a reminder, you are muted, but you're welcome to use the Q&A function during the program to send questions. Now the introduction of our speaker. Dr. Aaron Lehrman is Vice President of the Jerusalem Institute for Strategy and Security. If you don't know this institute, you really need to go look it up. That's the Jerusalem Institute for Strategy and Security. Great stuff, great scholars. A reserve colonel in the IDF, Aaron was Deputy Director for Foreign and International Affairs at the National Security Council in the Israeli Prime Minister's office. He held senior positions in IDF military intelligence for over 20 years. He also spent 8 years as director of the Israel and Middle East Office of the American Jewish Committee. He teaches in the Middle East Studies program at Shalem College in Jerusalem and in postgraduate programs at Tel Aviv University and the National Defense University. He is an expert, as you can imagine, on Israel's foreign relations and the broader Middle East. A third-generation Sabra, he holds a PhD from the London School of Economics and a mid-career MPA from Harvard University. I first met Aaron when he was a colonel in the IDF. I won't say how long ago that was, but I had brought a delegation of American military.
You were a kid or something.
We were kids. We were all kids. It's true. We were kids. But I had brought a delegation of American military professionals to Israel, and he was on our schedule. I thought then, and I think now, that he is one of Israel's best analysts. And so, Aaron Lehrman, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much for having me at the Jewish Policy Center. I should add to my credits, I would say, not exactly being a competitor, but a contributor to the debate. I'm also now the editor-in-chief of a new magazine, which has the interesting distinction of being published by a Moroccan Muslim who is an ardent friend of Israel, Ahmed Sharai, whom I came to know in my AJC years. And that's another place where you might find some interesting debates going on, particularly on this question we're going to discuss now on Iran. And one of the points I've made recently, and I've been making for years now, is that we need to remind ourselves first and foremost of something very basic. Why is Iran considering Israel an enemy? We are not a threat to any Iranian national interest. We actually, as I keep saying, have a monument in Israel to Israeli-Iranian friendship as it was until the late 70s. It is 200 kilometers long and it leaks from time to time. It's called the Eilat-Ashkelon pipeline, and it was built to carry Iranian crude to Mediterranean shores. Of course, yes, we did have a slight problem with some Persians 2,500 years ago, and which is the reason we get drunk on Purim. But I don't think that's really an issue nowadays. The problem lies very deep, and it lies elsewhere. It has to do with the ambition, the self-perception of the Iranian revolution under Khomeini and now Khamenei, much lesser light in terms of religious and intellectual capacity, but still the inheritor of his mantle as supreme leader. Their ambition to lead the Muslim world and then the world in a revolution that will finally validate their side of the ancient debate on the future of Islam between Shia and Sunnah. For years, generations, centuries, the Shia were the persecuted minority, the outlying element in Islam, world of Islam dominated by Sunnis. For them being in the bid now, I'm cutting short a long argument, today for the Iranian revolution, which has redefined what it means to be Shia, being in the business of destroying Israel, being in a position to do what the Sunni cowards and traitors have decided not to do from Sadat onwards, is central to who they are. This is not about doing, this is about being. This is identity politics. And very often, in my experience, certainly in our part of the world, but not only in our part of the world, identity politics tend to overturn the logic of interest, of cost and benefit. Sometimes, you know, when, you know, I'll use a very trite image. When you buy a pickup truck, you buy it in order to carry your goods from here to there at the lowest cost. When you buy for, let's say, a Maserati, you buy it for a very different reason. And the higher the cost, the more it adds to the notion of who you are. The higher the cost that goes into making Iran, Israel, the one player left in the game still pursuing the destruction of Israel, when everyone else in the region have more or less succumbed to the idea that Israel is a fact. Of course, Iran and its proxies and its allies and its dependents and its sponsored organizations across the region, that makes Tehran in its own, the leadership in Tehran in its own mind, a claimant to a historic role of the First Order. And that justified the immense cost to Iran of what they have been trying to do. So we have not pursued a rivalry or an enmity with Iran. It was very much Iran's choice. I still remember that in the Directorate of Military Intelligence, we dismantled the Iranian section because we thought, you know, once they are done fighting and surviving the war with Saddam Hussein in the 1980s, they'll settle down into a more normal existence. And the exact opposite is what happened. To justify all the iniquities and failures that the Iranian Revolution had, and not to mention repression and death and torture, that the Iranian revolutionary leadership has inflicted on its own people, to justify all this, Israel becomes and continues to be central to who they are, and therefore also central to their nuclear military project. And that's the second point. I think we are past the point in the debate in which anyone can still latch on to all kinds of nonsense about a fatwa, a religious injunction by the leader that Iran Iran is not interested in the bomb. This is a military project. It was always a military project. Even before we stole the archive, we knew that, if only because it is simply the right size. It is not big enough to be civilian, and it's not small enough to be researched. It's the size, it's not an elephant, it's not a cat, it's a horse, a war horse, it's always been a war horse. It's not accidentally the size of the Pakistani enrichment program, which was military from day one. And it was, of course, A.Q. Khan who sold the Iranians the technology that they are now using and improving. And so they are committed to our destruction, and they are committed to getting the bomb. Nobody enriches to 60% or let alone 90% for any other purpose. And they stopped the pretense of not being interested. So all of this makes this a fundamental question for us. It raises in the minds of Israelis in high places, and for the last 20 years, the question of applying the so-called Begin Doctrine, enunciated by Menachem Begin in 81 after the bombing of the Osirak facility in Iraq, just short of its going hot. And of course, it has been applied since by the Olmert government in 2007 in Syria, something it took us 11 years to admit to have done. But there's a doctrine that obliges Israeli governments of all colors to prevent a sworn enemy of Israel from having the capacity to destroy us. So this is hanging in the background. This is very much central to the ultimate question we may at some point have to face. But at the same time, and this is a typical Fitzgerald situation where you have two contradictory ideas and you try not to lose your capacity to act. The contradictory idea is that this is not our business alone. This is not only about Israel. Iran breaking the barrier, Iran becoming a threshold nuclear power or a military nuclear power, let alone a military nuclear power, is a catastrophe for the entire region and for the future of the world. Some people try to dismiss it as if it is a story not unlike that of North Korea. You know, so the crazy young boy has a few toys. Why should we worry? Look, it has not upset the balance of power in the Eastern Pacific. It has not driven Japan or even South Korea to pursue the same path. It has not led to the collapse of the NPT, etc. But the comparison is wrong. Iran is not North Korea. North Korea is a totally isolated hermit colony with no followers of its creed anywhere beyond its tightly shut borders. There's no takers of Jew chair. I don't think even in American academic institutions you don't find admirers of North Korea, I think. Iran is a different story. Iran, by the way, has apologists in important places in American academic life. But beyond that, it has proxies, allies, agents, subversive elements at play across the entire region and beyond it, all extending all the way to Venezuela and the triangle in the south between Brazil, Paraguay, and Argentina, the Western African seaboard, where there's a good number of Shia Lebanese families established now for generations. And of course, in the region itself, clearly, they are now, in their own words, in possession or partial possession of four Arab capitals. Beirut is in the deadly grip of Hezbollah, which is a fully owned Iranian proxy. Damascus, I would say, is a condominium of Iranian and Russian influence. But in Baghdad, Kazemi is struggling to shed off a total dependence on violent pro-Iranian or Iranian-sponsored factions and proxies. And of course, in Yemen, there's a war raging, and more than half the country is under the control of the Houthi uprising, which is, again, a Shia movement with nowadays a deep and abiding affiliation with Iran. And this is not the end of the story, because you have subversive elements in the eastern seaboard of the Arabian Peninsula, Shia elements in Bahrain, etc., etc. Under a nuclear umbrella, Iran would easily come to dominate the regions. That's not North Korea. Moreover, because the People's Republic of China is already a threat, Japan and North Korea and South Korea are settled into the American nuclear umbrella, and so did Australia, Taiwan, and others, without having to take too much notice of a North Korean bomb. An Iranian bomb, we know this for certain, will drive Saudi Arabia, Turkey. Erdogan is already muttering darkly that the number five is not sacrosanct, if you understand what that means. The five authorized nuclear powers under the NPT. Egypt, which for years has been able to live in its own way, with its the perceived capacity of Israel in their own minds, but they will not tolerate a situation where a Shia challenger of to Muslim leadership will actually ask Egypt to toe a line. So the world, the region, and then the world will be thrown into a nuclear arms race. Exactly what the entire international community has been trying to prevent since the Cuban Missile Crisis led to the promulgation of the NPT in the late 60s, and it's coming into power in 1970. The North Korean cracked the dam, but the dam did not come down. The cross crack, the Iranian cross crack, will be the end of the NPT system as we know it. This may delight Mr. Mearsheimer, but it doesn't give me much hope for the future of the world. Beyond that, there are also other two differences which are relevant to what I'm about to say about Israeli policy, but should also be relevant to American policy. Unlike North Korea, Iran is vulnerable to pressure, is vulnerable to sanctions. This is a society historically integrated in world affairs, in the global economy, in the regional economy. Its isolation hurts and has led it before to come to the negotiating table. I would give credit to the Obama administration in its first term of office, and specifically to the Secretary of State at the time, Hillary Clinton, for building a very effective sanction system that basically had the support of the international community. I would not give credit to the negotiators in the second term who frittered that very impressive array of tools away in a negotiation which basically catered to Iranian needs. But it is a country vulnerable to sanctions and to pressures, and these pressures should be applied effectively. Literally, given where the global fossil fuel economy is going, we have the Iranians over a barrel, an empty barrel, if you wish, and that leverage should be used to the hilt instead of being thrown away at the just to regain a symbolic, some kind of symbolic agreement. If you are going to have an agreement, and Israel is not opposed to an agreement, so go back to Netanyahu's speech at the before the two houses of Congress back in 2015, and you will see he didn't say no agreement, but he did say that no agreement is better than a bad agreement. And this is a bad, and this was and is a bad agreement. And the other point about North Korea is that, frankly, there's never been a military option. in the Korean Peninsula, not because the U.S. is afraid, but because the South Koreans will never have it. Their miracle on the Han River, what they've done after in Seoul and Incheon, is breathtaking. But it's also 50 kilometers, 30 miles, 2 days quick march with fixed bayonets for the huge North Korean standing army from the DMZ. They never would allow the U.S. to go to war for something that does not ultimately threaten them any more than the huge North Korean military threatens them already. In their calculus, and they have a rational calculus, this is not worth it. We have a different view. Given the nature of our Iranian enmity, the nature of what will happen to the region if they have the bomb, for us, the military option is preferable, despite to Iran having the bomb, despite the fact that Hezbollah alone has upwards of 120,000 to 150,000 rockets of various degrees of accuracy aimed at basically every population center in Israel. We would need to contend with the consequences of such a war, and we are willing to do it if this remains the only way, the one and only way, to prevent Iran from having the bomb. Which brings me to what I've written recently for the JISS, a reminder of or a revival of a position that I formalized when I was still in government. At the time, still talking to the, as it was, to the Obama administration, and it's still as relevant now as it was then, I believe. And I sum it up as the three no-con principles. No-con, nothing to do with neocons, just no-cons. No containment, no constraint, and no contradiction. Let me quickly explain. There can be no containment of a nuclear Iran the way the Soviet Union or even Mao's China with the bomb had been contained. For the reasons I've just explained, this will ignite a very dangerous regional arms race, and it is related to a millennial Iranian wish to position themselves at the vanguard of the effort to wipe Israel off the face of the earth, and therefore containment is not an option at the end of the day. There can be no constraint, and there has been an American commitment over the years and repeated, I think, in recent years, in the recent, by the Biden administration, that Israel is entitled to defend herself by herself, and I should add, also according to her own lights, based on Israel's reading of the level of danger and the nature of the challenge. Any constraint on that would be a mistake. As you may know or recall from reading Bob Gates' memoirs or from other sources, there was a bitter debate when inside the Bush 43 administration in 2007 whether or not to let Israel go on the Syrian nuclear project. And there were people who wanted to make it diplomatic, who wanted to restrain Israel. There were people who even at the other end of the spectrum, there was a vice president supporting American action. At the end of the decision, the president took a decision to let Israel make its own mind and its own decision on this matter. And it proved to be the right decision. It was the right decision then. It would be the right decision now. Finally, there's no contradiction between, and our leadership, including the Foreign Minister Yair Lapid just recently, have been saying it again and again. Having a credible military threat, a term so important that like everything else in the IDF, it should have its own initials. Having a CMT does not contradict negotiations and does not contradict the use of other levers such as sanctions, it enhances the prospects of success in both cases. Let me explain. If the Iranians assume that they can get away with the nuclear project, then they would use the negotiations to waste time and get there. And they would tell their own people that the sanctions are worth suffering because ultimately they would get to a position where they can lay down the rules and they can also extract the goods from the entire region and finally turn around the cycle that engulfed Iran since the revolution and make it not only into a hegemonistic religious superpower, but also into a prosperous place. That would be the promise. Unless it is made very clear to leadership and lay Iranians alike that they will never have the bomb. So all the suffering enduring the sanctions and playing games with the negotiations will avail them nothing. And therefore, a credible military threat clearly put forward actually helps gives the negotiators a better position and gives sanctions a much more effective imprint on the mind of the people on the other side of the table. I believe that some of this is understood on both sides of the Atlantic. The present Israeli government, unlike the impression created by Netanyahu at the personal level, is not interested in introducing itself into the American political debate. Netanyahu has managed to come to have himself perceived as a Republican. This is not the position of the present Israeli government. They're interested in coming to practical terms with any American administration that shares our ultimate goals. And so the two professionals here, Jake Sullivan on the American side, who understands the issues, I believe, and so does Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin. And on our side, specifically, Minister of Defense Gantz and the National Security Advisor Eyal Hulata, a nuclear physicist with a Mossad background, who had more to do with the undoing of a nuclear project than the doing of a nuclear project. But they can have a serious conversation about what is at stake. There are still major differences as to what is a bearable and acceptable agreement. The gaps have not entirely closed. But, and here's my final point, given the arrogance of the Iranian position, given their sense until recently, that they can get away with basically laying down the terms for the negotiations in Vienna, then we may face a situation where even with the best intentions of an American administration eager to come back to an agreement, they will not be able to swallow what the Iranians are trying to dictate. And at that point, we would be facing a situation where we should put our heads together, looking at the whole range of options that we have, from sanctions through the full range of non-kinetic measures, that's to say ways of making derailing the Iranian project without actually sending aircraft to bomb it, and all the way down to the possibility of military action. I find it interesting, and that's my final point, that when Ministry of Defense Benny Gantz was in Washington recently, it was leaked, not from our side, but from the American side, that an exercise simulating an offensive joint operation, not defensive like Blue Flag and other exercises we've already held. But simulating an offensive operation would be on the table. The least I could say is that this kind of leak indicates that people in Washington also understand the utility of a CMT, of a credible military threat. Where will all of this take us now depends on whether the Iranians will get the message and relent at Vienna, or are we headed, as still seems to be the case, towards the collapse of these negotiations and the need to rethink strategy, both in Israel and in Washington.
Okay, this leaves us with an enormous number of questions. So people have been sending questions, and let's talk about those things. Question one from someone who's listening. Given American policy failures in the region, in other words, Afghanistan and in containing the Russians and the Chinese and Iranian aggression, why would Israel believe the United States has staying power on the issue of Iran? Does the Israeli government worry about us not being there when you need us there?
Well, there's a good old saying in Hebrew, Ashrei Adam Mefached Tamid. Better off, I wouldn't say happy, but better off is he who is always afraid, and we are afraid that the U.S. will not be there when we need it, and this is why we've been building our own homemade capacities with the help of the United States, but ultimately in terms of our own assets and our own capabilities. There's no question, they remain inferior to what the U.S. can bring to bear. We cannot carry MOABs or MOPs to a target. We cannot give blanket coverage to the Iranian air defense system if the need arises. We can act much more locally and surgically. That's not to say we cannot act, but we cannot act as extensively as effectively. But we are not sure. We are not sure the U.S. would be there, that the U.S. would make that decision, given the growing reluctance about the use of force. Both sides of the aisle, I have to say, in American politics, and we've heard some very dispiriting things about the folly of military action also from the previous administration or the previous president. So we have plenty to worry about. The only thing that may balance this out is simply the understanding, which may be forced upon all of us by Iranian arrogance, by an Iranian miscalculation, that the alternatives are even worse. And Israel's position is this. There will be action. If it will be yours, it will be better. But you are not going to make be able to resolve this without at least a credible threat of action, either by the U.S. or by Israel, preferably together.
On the other hand, because there's always another hand, if destroying Israel is, first of all, a religious, not a political imperative for the Shiite movement in Iran, and at the same time, it does cover up their political and economic failings because they can tell their people it's in pursuit of something bigger. Ultimately, why would they negotiate? I mean, ultimately, how do they give that up? They say to themselves, okay, we let our people overthrow us instead. Why are we talking to them?
The reason, well, that's an answer. That's a good question. They were scared badly in 2003. It can be dismissed now, but the Bush administration back then was able to scare them badly, given what just happened in Afghanistan and in Iraq. The sanction system later, we saw that the military threat is capable of stopping them in their tracks if they feel that this could actually lead to the destruction of the regime on a shorter notice. they were not. They looked at what happened in Libya and where Gaddafi laid himself bare because of what just happened in Iraq. So we know from 2003 when they actually stopped their working on their weapon group, not on their enrichment program, but on their weapon group, that they are not incapable of understanding the possible implication of a knock to their head. And as they were increasingly subject to exposure through the combination of Iranian dissidents and the Western, several Western intelligence services, I think they're capable of being frightened. They were also under very heavy duress after UN Security Council Resolution 1929, which at the time was supported by China and Russia. By the way, the Chinese would not have supported it had we not told them. I was there when we told them. That was Yalon and actually Stanley Fisher, our banker, going there to explain to them the economic consequences of such a war. We told them your choice is not between sanctions and a happy business-like atmosphere with Iran. The choice is between joining the sanctions system or facing a war that could disrupt the global economic system and therefore also derail China's growth trajectories. They got the message. Dai Bing Guo was intelligent enough, and the Iranians found themselves totally isolated, unless you count Brazil as a friend. So when they are frightened and when they are under very heavy pressure, they will do the short-term calculation over the long-term calculation and come to the table. And they can be squeezed at the table if you have, forgive my crude Mexican, if you have the cojones to squeeze them. But this is not exactly what actually happened between 2013 and 2015. The United States frittered away a position of immense capacity to pressure Iran in order to get a quick, relatively quick, in Iranian terms, relatively quick resolution. And that's the tragedy of the JCPOA.
So would you say that the maximum sanctions campaign of the last administration was a better way to go? Was that having the impact that you would have liked to see?
Well, it's backed by the action against, let me put it more carefully. It needed to be backed by a credible military threat. When nothing happened after the downing of an American major attack on an American drone, and then nothing happened after Abqaiq, the IRGC attack on the Saudi oil facilities, questions began to arise as to whether the sanctions are a cover for not doing anything in the military field. And then, as I said, there should be complementarity between the sanction system, the pressure system, and the credible military threat. What did change the equations was the elimination of Qasem Soleimani, which came as a shock to the Iranian system. So we shall never know, but 4 more years of that could have had could have pushed the Iranians to a much less arrogant position than they are holding now.
So let's shift the focus a little bit. We have a question here about all of our focus seems to be on Iranian nuclear capability. Can we shift the focus a little bit to something else, which is to say, couldn't diplomacy be a way that Iran diverts people's attention from the conventional threats? You mentioned Iraq and Syria and Lebanon, and all of those are poised to threaten Israel now that Israel got rid of the Syrian nuclear project. All of them are poised to threaten Israel conventionally. So this raises two questions. One, is Iran trying to divert our attention? And number two, if there was a military strike and Hezbollah were to retaliate against Israel, being the proxy of Iran, being the lapdog of Iran, if you like, Is Israel prepared to deal with those conventional problems?
Well, we don't have hours, but I can give you a short version of the answer.
Take the short version.
First of all, the decision was taken back in 2015 and again now, not to bring the regional subversion activities of Iran into the negotiated equation. This was, we believed at the time this was a mistake. We still believe it's a mistake. We are not the only ones who say it's a mistake. So do the Saudis and the Emiratis and the Egyptians and the Jordanians and everyone else who feels the brunt of Iranian subversion attempts. So in an ideal world, this should be on the table as well, but it is not. So it leaves us in the position of dealing with it as best we can ourselves, and the Saudis doing what they can to bribe and cajole Kazemi and others in Iraq away from, and they've done some pretty they've made some pretty good progress. Muqtada Sadr may not be my my choice for a date for my granddaughters, but he is anti-Iranian enough and close enough to Sistani and the non the anti-Iranian Shia elements in Iraq. And he won the last elections at the expense of the Iraq, of the pro-Iranian politicians in Iraq. So the Iraqi game is open. I think this is what President Biden tried to signal by inviting Kazemi to the virtual summit for democracy in early December. As for Syria and Lebanon, there's something going on called the CBW by its shorthand. You see, I've been long enough the IDF to be enamored with shorthands. This is the campaign between the wars, or the Mabam by its Hebrew initials, Maracha ben HaMilchamot, which is an ongoing, intense campaign to destroy the Iranian bid to take Syria and turn it into an Iranian stronghold, and to supply Hezbollah with, significant technological advantages. The IDF recently released its numbers. More than 1,000 fighter sorties were flown in 2021. And not all of them were in the Gaza conflict in May. Let's say that hundreds were flown in Syria. We never admit, it's fascinating. Israel never admits to any single specific action in Syria unless it comes in a response to a very specific provocation from Syria. Generally, we don't own up to any of these raids. However, we do own up to the fact that we are doing it in a general sense, in aggregate, day in and day out, with some significant results. One of the results is that the Russians, and maybe even Assad, have come to understand that the survival of Assad's regime may be threatened if he turns his country into an Iranian playground. So we've seen some indications recently that both the Russians on the ground and Assad at a certain level are curbing Iranian activity. So it's an interesting development. And we, of course, intend to continue full force. By the way, in the process, we are almost also signaling to our overt friends in the UAE and our less overt friends in Saudi Arabia that we mean what we say and we mean business. Now, are we prepared for a full-scale war with Hezbollah? I would say that much depends on the resilience of the Israeli rear, and the resilience, and because the Israeli rear is going to suffer. And the resilience of the rear areas in war is not a technical question. It's a question of morale and purpose. If it would come to be understood that this is not a war that's going to be fought for another bloody draw like 2006, And this would end in the elimination of Hezbollah as a major fighting force. Then the majority of Israelis would be willing to endure what it takes until it's done. Then we would need to see a much greater effectiveness in the use of our ground forces than we've had to see in the last 40 years. Because the last time an Israeli saw, you know, you have to be 60 in Israel to have seen an Arab tank in battle. Of course, Hezbollah does not have tanks, but it will require a much larger military ground operation than anything we fought since 82. But the consequences for Hezbollah would be devastating because Lebanon is full of Sunnis and Christians and even frustrated Shiites who know what this organization has done to their country over the last, and to Syrians on the other side of the border over the last 10 years, 20 years. And once they are terminally enfeebled by Israeli military action, people will come after them with rusty knives. So there just may be enough of a deterrent when the day comes. And Hassan Nasrallah has to think, is he being asked to commit collective suicide, not only his, but that of his community on behalf of Iranian interests?
That's both optimistic and pessimistic at the same time. We're starting to be in my business. It helps. I'm usually pessimistic, but I try to end on an optimistic note at the end of a program. So let's see if we can get there. Before we get there, though, I do have a question from a listener. You mentioned that the Israeli government in its current incarnation is not interested in playing U.S. politics. It is interested in working with the U.S. government, the government that we have, right? And that's fine. The question is, do you think that the Biden administration is sending the right message to Iran, that they will not allow them to get the bomb, that they will reinstitute sanctions if they have to? They probably shouldn't have given up what they gave up. Are the Iranians afraid of the Biden administration? I mean, it seems to me I would want them to be. Are they?
Not yet. I think their reading of Biden is basically colored by his public image as, a very peace-loving, a quiet individual absorbed by the challenges of the domestic American scene. And also by Afghanistan, and which wasn't a pretty picture. But if I look at the actual lineup of the key players, and basically we're talking about three or four people beyond Biden himself, who would ultimately be there in the room making these decisions. And all my friends, your side of the water will have to forgive me if I don't necessarily count the vice president. We're talking about Jake Sullivan. We're talking about Tony Blinken. And we're talking about Lloyd Austin and the military. Now, Austin, for example, is a person who certainly is not a happy warrior, but he has spent years understanding the defense needs of the Gulf, which is ultimately, you know, the sum of all fears for a CENTCOM commander is the collapse of the capacity of the United States to defend its crucial historical interests in the Gulf. Now, we all know that energy is not as important as it used to be, but it for the United States, which has become a net exporter, but it is vital for China and India and Japan. And if you have a pivot to Asia, you pivot on a hinge, and the hinge remains the Gulf. And so for sheer strategic reasons, national interest reasons of the first order, I think there are people in this administration who understand what it would actually mean for the United States to drop the ball on the Iranian nuclear project. whether the Iranians, I think the signals have started to come out after the seventh round in Vienna, that the U.S. is seriously thinking about all options, and that tightening up of sanctions and other measures. And let's remember that between an all-out attack and the current situation, there's a whole range of other things that could be done and have been done. The Obama administration was fully complicit with Israel on Olympic Games, as you may recall, on the people later came to call the Stuxnet. I think the Iranians should maybe started getting the message in the last few weeks. We shall know more in the next few days, I think, when things begin to when the smoke clears from the current discussions in Vienna.
Okay, let's go shifting again. How closely would you say U.S. and Israeli intelligence match on where the Iranians are, where they're going, what it is that the IAEA has not seen yet that it needs to see? So how tightly attuned are the two governments on an intel level? And do their assessments agree?
My short answer would be very close.
That's good.
Historically, there have been problems in the past. The previous administration used Israeli intelligence where it shouldn't have. The administration previous to that was worried that some intelligence would be used for Israel by Israel for military action that it did not favor. I don't think we are there nowadays. I think we are looking at a fairly close, intense dialogue. And I think some of the illusions of the past are no longer relevant. I sat in meetings 12, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, in which people tried to argue to us that the Iranians are basically just need a deterrent because they live in a rough neighborhood, the Pakistanis are there, etc. I think we've moved past that point with most Americans we speak to.
Okay, we're moving closer to the optimistic ending that I want for this program. So I'm going to ask the last question. Regular listeners know the last question is always one to which the guest is expected to say something positive. We haven't, you mentioned the Gulf. I mean, that was clear that Lloyd Austin is an expert in the Gulf and the problems of the Gulf and the countries of the Gulf. We haven't exactly spoken about the Abraham Accords. So the Abraham Accords have celebrated a birthday. They do seem to be doing an awful lot of good stuff for Israel and the Gulf countries. What is the effect on Israel's Iran policy? Are they taking into account? Are they coordinating with? Are they reassuring? What is Israel doing with its Gulf new Gulf friends and Saudi Arabia, which is a sort of a friend, but not really?
Well, with the Saudis, of course, it's all covert, but it is, I believe, quite firm and occasionally quite detailed in terms of a mutual understanding of what is at stake. We need to remind ourselves from time to time that the last person to compare Khamenei to Hitler was not Netanyahu, but MBS. And that's a fact. And although they do speak to the Iranians on certain issues, such as trying to balance out the mutual interests in Iraq, and the Emiratis obviously do have to hedge a bit because they are as worried as we are about where the U.S. may be heading, but they are. The situation reminds me of King Hussein's famous standard joke about the pigs and chicken who had decided to establish a cooperative for ham and eggs. But the chicken had an interest, but the pigs were committed. So they are more committed perhaps even than we are because they have territory under Iranian occupation and they live right next to the monster. So they play games. But at the end of the day, we work together. And I think if there's leaving aside the Abraham Accords on the diplomatic and economic and cultural and all their other aspects, what we've been seeing is an intensification of military cooperation, the likes of which we've never seen before. The Fifth Fleet has been conducting exercises with the Bahraini, Emirati, and Israeli Navy. That's unheard of. The commander of the UAE Air Force came to visit Israel at the time of the Blue Flag exercise and then participated in a conference on F-35s. He may not actually end up buying them, but he was there. By the way, a stray German photographer actually caught sight of a Jordanian tail exercising in the Blue Flag. So you get a sense that our relations with the Arab world today are nothing like what all of us grew up with a generation ago or even 5 years ago. And in this respect, I think beyond that, just think of something like Blue Flag, where the best air forces in the world come to study, learn, and work with the Israeli Air Force, which is perhaps the leading practitioner using F-35s in anger. And what that tells the Iranians about Israeli capability and the attractiveness of Israel as a partner for the international community. It sends a message to the Palestinians. Gentlemen, if you thought you could isolate Israel, you failed. Think again. And it sends a message to the Iranians. We will be there if no other choice is left.
And that, I think, is the place that we want to end this conversation, because it is optimistic. We didn't do Palestinians at all, but you end up on an optimistic note that Israel's place in the region is more secure in many ways than it used to be. Although you have the Iranian threat, although you still have Palestinian problems, Israel's being in the region seems to be more secure and more stable than it ever has been. And on that note, I would like to thank you, Aaron Lehrman, on behalf of our listeners and on behalf of the Jewish Policy Center. Thank you for a very, very enlightening program. Everybody else, we'll be back next week. Icon Erdemir, Turkey, really good stuff. We will see you in a week. Aaron, thank you.
You're welcome, Shoshana. Good to see you.